You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Friday, June 17th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined in our actual studio, as opposed to the virtual one that we've been using a fair amount over the last couple of years, by Charity Clark, who is running for the Democratic Party's nomination for Attorney General here in Vermont. She served as the Assistant Attorney General in the State Attorney General's office for the past 7 years, and including the past 4 years as Chief of Staff, before stepping down a few weeks ago when she announced her candidacy for the Attorney General's office. That, of course, follows the incumbent Attorney General T.J. Genovese's announcement that he would be stepping down to take a job in the private sector. The primary election is on August 9th, and Charity Clark is facing a primary contest with Rory Tebolt, who is the state's attorney for Washington County. And as some of you may know, we had an interview with him earlier this week. Ms. Clark, welcome to the News Project.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be home.
Right, because as I was about to mention, I almost forgot, you're from Manchester, a graduate of Burn Burton. I guess back when it was Burn Burton, Burn Burton Seminary, right?
Yes.
As opposed to Burn Burton Academy. I had to think about that for a second.
I will tell you, Andrew, when I posted on Facebook that I was joining the board of Burn Burton, because I also now serve on the board, I had quite a few class of 1993 classmates who wanted to correct me and say that it was not Burn Burton Academy, but Burn Burton Seminary. Still a controversial topic for some
I'm
folks.
I'm sure. Yeah, well, I remember when that name change went through back in the, I guess it was the mid-90s era, I think.
I think it was the
turn
of
after you graduated.
Yeah.
Created a bit of a stir at the time.
Yeah.
No question. Well, anyway, thanks again for making the time to be with us. And we're most interested to hear your views on what you think is important in the Attorney General's office and what you would be doing if elected. So I guess I'd just like to start off by asking you, what are some of your main priorities you'd like to focus on should you prevail in November?
Well, look, I've been in the office for several years now, so my vision for the office has been informed by my experience working in the office, especially the last 4 years as a member of the leadership team as chief of staff. And I should just orient your viewers a little bit to what the Attorney General's office does. There's several divisions in the office. So when I tell you what my priorities are, it might sound like I'm bouncing around, but I think this will help explain. So the seven divisions are, let's see if I can name them, civil, public protection, environmental, criminal, the appellate division, the general counsel and administrative law division. I have forgotten one. It'll come to me and I'll fill you in. Oh, it's the Human Services Division. So given that breadth of all of those topics, you know, here's where I really want to focus. Some of these are legislative initiatives that I had started working on before I left the office. One of them is working on data privacy, especially for our children. And this is something that's in the consumer space. So it's been a number of years that I was supervising the Consumer Assistance Program. And legislation to expand the current privacy laws, I think, are good for all of us, especially our children. I also think we should expand the sealing and expungement law that was narrowly defeated, I think, this past legislative session. And I think that a compromise position is a worthwhile next step for the January session when that begins. I really believe strongly in the work of the Attorney General's office with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force that is housed in the Attorney General's office, and it handles child pornography cases, possession and distribution largely of child pornography. The majority of the criminal cases handled by the Attorney General's office are related to child pornography and handled by that unit. So making sure that they are well-resourced, have what they need to do their incredibly important work will certainly be a priority for me in January. I also believe strongly that we need to do everything we can to address global warming and climate change. And we have in Vermont a climate action plan. I, as Attorney General, will be a robust and enthusiastic partner in trying to accomplish those goals set out by the climate action, the Climate Council. In the space of opioids, the crisis, you know, in Vermont continues. It's very heartbreaking to be traveling around the state as I am, and wherever I go, someone seems to be affected by the opioid crisis. We all are. We all are touched in some way by a friend, a relative, a neighbor, and the way that the Attorney General's office can really act in that space is by making sure that those who are responsible for the crisis are held accountable. And I will zealously continue those lawsuits that are currently pending against those folks. I could go on and on, but I'll stop there.
Well, I thought it might be interesting to unpack a few of those things.
Sure.
And one of them I'd love to hear more about would be you had stated at one point a little while ago that you would like to see an expansion of the state's expungement laws. I wondered if you could elaborate a bit on that. When we say expungement, usually that references like low-level crimes and mm-hmm. that a person might have committed at a previous point in their lives, mm-hmm. which now may no longer be relevant to, let's say, something that a potential employer might want to know about.
That's just it. I'll give you an example. When I first started, I oversaw the Attorney General's expungement clinics, where we tried to help people get their records either expunged or sealed, depending on what the crime was. And the first person I helped, which was over 2 years ago, I think, they had on their record a bad check that they, two bad checks, they wrote in the late 90s, I think, and it was preventing them, and they had no other crime since then. So all this time had passed, 20 years, more than 20 years, and it was still on their record, and it was preventing them from applying for a better job, and they did the kind of work that was, you know, in finance or something. And I remember being really struck. First of all, you know, you relate to the person. I think they were, you know, roughly my age, and I just thought, like, this is, you know, a crime. They had paid their debt to society, if you will, and yet it was still with them and still affecting their lives. And it doesn't make sense, especially there's not evidence that shows that 20 years later you haven't committed a crime and there's going to be a risk that you're going to commit that crime again. There's just not any evidence to back that up. So it really makes sense to help folks move on with their lives, be better members of society, better parents to their kids. They can go on field trips with those removed. So that's kind of the status, the way things are right now. And for a number of years, the legislature has tried to get a bill passed that expands that to include some higher level crimes and either have those sealed or expunged. Sealing means that they are sealed from the general public, but certain people would be able to still access those, you know. I think that there has not been an agreement about the best approach between the legislature and the governor's office, and it has repeatedly prevented efforts from actually expanding the statute. So I've worked on that for a number of years, and I would love in January to continue working on that and help a bill get across the finish line that meets the legislature's hopes and expectations, and also the governor, so that we can actually get it done and expand that law.
And another area you've been deeply involved in so far at the Attorney General's office is around scams or people calling to get you to do something.
Yes.
It turns out to be a bad deal. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your background in that area and kind of what you think we should be doing about that to alleviate that problem.
Sure. One of the, if not the main, I'm going to say the main way that Vermonters interface with the Attorney General's office is in the consumer assistance program kind of arena. You know, when someone says, I'm going to call the Attorney General's office, they're calling the consumer assistance program. And that program gets 15,000 contacts made with consumers every year. And it also has 5,000 scam reports made. And, you know, every year we released the top scams of the year, you know, the most common scams that we saw. And as you probably are not surprised to hear, those evolved. You know, the scammers, everyone kind of caught on to the IRS scam. 5 years ago, that was the hot scam. And now it's not even on the top 10 because they realize it's not working. Now, just FYI, it's the tech support scam is really dangerous and I think really easy to fall for. Would you like me to explain the tech support scam?
Yeah, because I haven't gotten one of those calls yet, but now I'm, getting nervous.
No, sometimes it is a call, but often it's on your computer. So you're minding your own business and a pop-up appears, oh, there's a virus or something scary on your computer. Click here for help. And you're thinking, and they'll tell you they're a legitimate company, and then they want to be allowed to remote access into your computer, which is a disaster. And, you know, some of the biggest losses to scams last year were a result of the tech support scam where someone had just happened to have opened their bank account or their brokerage account or their cryptocurrency account, and the scammer could just transfer all of their money to their own account. So that one is really problematic. So the issue with scams is there's more every year. And as technology has made it easier for scammers to prey on, you know, law-abiding citizens who are just trying to mind their own business, it's really a problem. And scammers are almost always overseas. It makes it very difficult to shut them down. So there are a couple of tools in the toolbox, and the first is education, just making sure that we're talking about scams, telling people what to look out for, and helping folks get that education that will help protect them. And the second is getting creative about how to stop robocalls. Robocalls, you know, for some of us, those are never going to work to scam us. But the reason why they're so common and popular is they are effective. And they're very inexpensive, you know, for a scammer to employ rather than, you know, a call room full of actual people. So right now there are some lawsuits, or one lawsuit I can think of before I left the Attorney General's office, that targeted the business who was channeling the scam call in. So if you have a call that's a robocall that's very short, it's usually a hang up, and that's a scam. We get so many scam reports at the Attorney General's office. We can do a trace back of a call to see if it's a scam, and then there's a company who's facilitating that scam, and to say to that company, you're facilitating a crime, and that's not okay, and really target those folks to try to protect Vermonters.
Well, someone who gets my share of scam calls.
Yes, we all do. I want to tell you, Andrew.
Too much ain't enough when it comes to fixing that problem.
Yes, I was testifying once, or maybe I was about to testify in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, and one on robocalls. And a senator received a scam call and put it on speakerphone, and everyone had a big laugh about it. But I mean, that's how insidious they are. So.
Well, another thing I know that you're kind of interested in is this question of, as you put it, bringing a renewed focus to issues of reproductive liberty and domestic violence. What would that renewed focus include?
Well, you know, for me, I, you know, have a little bit of history at the Attorney General's office, having worked there, and we've never had a woman Attorney General. There have been 26 men and 0 women attorneys general here in Vermont. So when I say renewed focus, that's what I mean, to have, you know, this fresh perspective of a woman for the first time looking at some of these issues. Domestic violence is something that is prevalent and has been forever. I think that we need to have a renewed focus, meaning let's take a look at this. Let's get the stakeholders together and think, is there anything more that we could be doing? Is it raising awareness? Is it funding? Is it systems? Because, you know, the CDC estimates that roughly half of homicides are related to domestic violence. And I should clarify, I use the term domestic violence because we all know what that means, but really it's intimate partner violence. They don't have to be living together. Intimate partner violence. We have in the Attorney General's office a Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission, which annually looks back at the year at the fatalities related to domestic violence to sort of do a case study and say, you know, what happened here, what can be done. They've made specific recommendations, as they do every year, and I will be a zealous advocate for those recommendations to try to address the problem and really be a champion for the work that they're doing. With regards to reproductive liberties, I think Vermont is really poised to I mean, we are very much on the vanguard, which is really exciting, to enshrine the right to reproductive liberty in the Constitution. And everyone this November will have an opportunity to vote for that. And I intend to vote for that. I'm very, very enthusiastic about that. You know, our office at the Attorney General's office was very involved with testifying and providing expertise to the legislature as they began the process of trying to amend the Constitution. It's where we are now. And also while they had passed initially a statute to ensure that we have protections here in Vermont, that there was no doubt about it, even if Roe v. Wade were removed from law. So I would continue that kind of collaboration and helpfulness as Attorney General.
Because I was wondering if the Supreme, the U.S. Supreme Court issues any opinion that seems like most people are expecting them to, following the leak of that draft opinion a month or so ago. Bearing in mind, of course, that was a draft, so it might be something different. But if it turns out to be something pretty similar, would Proposition 5, the constitutional amendment, I guess voters will be weighing in on in November, that would override a Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, right? I mean, that would, it's not like that came at a federal level and that overrides a state, even a state constitution.
We would have freedom here in Vermont. We would be protected. And the question becomes, you know, how, and for me, how can we be helpful to other Americans who have been deprived what I think is a human right to your own body autonomy? And as Attorney General, that's something that I would, you know, look to try to be helpful with, to make sure that that folks have that. But here in Vermont, we would have that. We have had that for even without Roe v. Wade, but we have had clarification, which has been really helpful, whatever that was 3-4 years ago. And the constitutional amendment will be even more helpful. And it honestly makes me proud to be a Vermonter. And I'm really excited to be able to vote in November for that.
Let me just shift gears for a second and hear from you about another area that I imagine you'd be dealing with, and that's the whole question of the quality of policing here in the state. Do you feel that police departments would benefit if they were restructured in some way, maybe having mental health workers or social workers embedded in them? And I guess I was wondering if those should be in addition to the existing cadre of uniformed officers, or would it be a case of some of those mental health workers could replace some of the uniformed officers at a time when a lot of those police departments are really struggling to maintain their staffing levels?
I think we're at a moment in history where we are looking at police accountability and, of course, implicit bias and all of racial profiling, as you say. And I think those conversations are incredibly important. There's a lot of ideas that have come out of those conversations, and I think continue to come out of them. Some of that, some of those topics occurred in the past legislative session, and I think it's really useful to build on those next year. And we certainly have, for example, there's a memo that is expected from the Legislative Council on Qualified Immunity, and hopefully will inform the legislature's work in January. And you know, to the extent we don't oversee the police or anything like that, but to the extent that the Attorney General's office can be a voice and be useful in weighing in on the legal matters and some of the expertise that we have. We do have a civil rights unit, which only handles employment discrimination, but they have a lot of expertise, of course, on constitutional law and that kind of area. So I think it's really important to have a seat at the table and be sure that that we're one of the stakeholders who are engaging that. It's incredibly important. And I'm really glad to see that the Bennington Police has done some work to try to make change in that police department and how the citizen have been involved.
I'd be curious to know what you thought of the decision that T.J. Donovan came to in the case involving Kaya Morris, where, as I'm sure you remember, she was one of the representatives, state representatives in Bennington, and wound up withdrawing because of concerns about racial harassment that she was receiving. And Mr. Donovan came down to Bennington and made an appearance and said he wasn't going to prosecute or bring a case against one of the individuals who was identified as being part of that harassment. And that, of course, created quite a stir at the time, and it really kind of pointed to that line between what is free speech and what sort of becomes a case of shouting fire in a crowded theater, as the Supreme Court case held it. And I guess I just wondered, you know, I realize Mr. Donovan was your boss at the time, but I mean, looking back now, what, 3 years later, almost, it must be at this point. What did you think about that decision? Was that grounded in a reasonable fact, or if it had been your job, would you have said, hey, you know, we need to really crack down on this. This was free speech is one thing, but that with freedom comes responsibility, and this was irresponsible.
You know, the Attorney General has to make a lot of hard decisions, and that one was one of them where you could see that that this was harassment. It did not rise to the level of a crime. The same free speech that protects an individual from criticizing Donald Trump maybe also protects speech I don't like as well, and that is that's just free speech in America. I think that. Having conversations about harassment of public officials is really important now when we see the discourse that's happening in this country. And Vermont's not immune from that. It's really important to be thinking creatively of ways to make sure that we are treating each other with respect and civility. And also, one of my concerns has been discouraging people from serving in public office or serving their communities. I mean, as you well know, in many of our communities, there is not a financial incentive for volunteering for your local school board, select board. I serve on my library board. I don't get paid for that, but I love doing it. And I think that it does make it hard to try to be a public servant when you might be facing that level of harassment. I think all of those things need to be discussed. It still upsets me to think about that. But there's a legal standard that needs to be applied, and that's what the Attorney General has to do.
Another case I wanted to ask you about was the EB-5 case. Mm-hmm. The Attorney General's office played a fairly important role in that. And I recall that at one point there was some resistance to releasing some of the documents that were being sought because through the discovery process, mm-hmm. I believe it's called. In general, do you think the Attorney General's office should have a kind of proactive approach to making public as many documents as possible, or... Where's the boundary line here on that? And I realize that was an incredibly complicated case.
Yeah.
And a lot going on, and we're still seeing it playing out. But I just wondered if, looking back, should those documents been able to become public sooner?
Mm-hmm. So the Public Records Act, the philosophy and everything is right there, and it comes from the legislature, and it started out after Watergate, the philosophy of the public deserves to have access to records, to know what their government is doing. And the preamble, it's sort of, you didn't realize it probably, but you were echoing that, like, yeah, if you can make these public, you should make them public. And, our office, I keep saying our because it's so recent that I was working there. The Attorney General's office defends the state when the state is sued. So if someone slipped on a puddle of water in the foyer of the state house and sued, we would defend. That is a regular lawsuit, which has discovery and attorney-client privilege and attorney work product and all of those privileges that that come with, like anyone would have in a lawsuit. And those are exempt from the Public Records Act. There are a number of other exemptions, one of which is that if a person who works in the government would violate an ethical rule by providing these records, then they don't have to provide the records. Well, of course, that is an ethical rule that lawyers have to protect documents that are privileged. And so, you know, in applied to the EB-5 case, of course, there was many documents that were either communications, they were protected by attorney-client privilege, or they were work product. And work product is, you know, when an attorney is making a record in anticipation of litigation, that's work product. So I, as chief of staff, I oversaw our work in public records requests. One of the things that we did, which I wholeheartedly have recommended to other agencies and certainly would continue as attorney general, is to post on our website all requests for public records, correspondence related to those requests, and the public records themselves to say, you know, someone wanted these, here they are, and they're out there. And I also would say, you know, we can redact portions of records that are exempt from the Public Records Act for the privilege or some other reason, and leave the rest. And the Public Records Act really tells you to do that. It says if there's parts that you can give over, give them over and redact the rest. It doesn't say it in those words, but the philosophy is to do that. I have been lucky enough to provide trainings on public records to other government agencies, like I mentioned the Climate Council, because that's a new agency. They needed to be trained on that. I believe really strongly in public transparency and accountability by government. You know, especially here in Vermont, everything's on the human scale, and it's so important that we continue the expectation that Vermonters have of having access to their government, having access to their elected officials. And I certainly would continue that philosophy as Attorney General.
Before we have to run, I did want to get in one question because you had mentioned something earlier about your interest in climate law and climate change. And there was a case, I guess, underway last September when Attorney General Donovan announced that the state had filed a lawsuit against the four largest suppliers of fossil fuels in Vermont, I guess arguing that those companies had misled consumers about their products' contribution to climate change. And I guess I just wondered, A, is that case still underway? That was now, what, about almost 8 or 9 months ago? And kind of how would you like to see that prosecuted further, depending on what phase it's at in the legal process?
Well, because I left the office, I don't want to speak on behalf of the office, but I will say that that lawsuit, I think, is incredibly important. And, you know, the philosophy of consumers have a right to be told the truth. So if you're misleading consumers, if you're deceiving them and saying, oh, you know, our product helps global warming instead and doesn't harm global warming, and consumers are making a choice based on your misrepresentation, that's completely not allowed under the law. And it's something, even in this context of these massive corporations, we should, of course, pursue that. I believe strongly that, you know, global warming is real. And from being, you know, in Vermont all these years, I know consumers make choices based on whether or not something is good for the environment. I mean, my stepdad has a bumper sticker on his car that says Vermont green before green was cool, right? And it's true. And people make choices here based on that. And so, you know, I think that's really meaningful and important to keep in mind. You know, here in particular, truly, people make choices based on how green something really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it there for today, but I want to thank you very much for making the time for our conversation today. Really appreciate that, and good luck out there on the campaign trail, and I'm sure all the bulldogs out there will be cheering you on.
I still love the fight song, Andrew, so
okay,
look out.
Well, that's good. There are some people that's a big deal.
Oh, good.
Well, and thanks to all of you as well for being with us today. We hope you've enjoyed our program and found it interesting, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us today. Meanwhile, have a great day. Thank you very much. Charity Clark is a candidate for Vermont Attorney General. She is running in the Democratic Party's primary for the nomination that will be decided on August 9th, and then perhaps on the election in November. We'll see what happens. I guess the voters will decide. You folks will decide. Meanwhile, have a great day, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.